As I mentioned earlier, we're continuing this morning to journey through the words of the Apostles' Creed. And today we come to this part of the Creed. Still talking about Jesus, this middle central paragraph, I believe in Jesus Christ, who suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended to the dead. Now, for some who were there 2,000 years ago, as these events took place, they represented for them a crushing disappointment. And it brought with it confusion. It brought with it the end of hope. And in Luke's Gospel, in chapter 24, right at the end of his Gospel, we're told this wonderful story of two people who had obviously trusted Jesus, two of his followers, two of his friends, and they're there on the road having seen Jesus die on the cross, and they're trying to make sense of it all and not getting very far, and they're joined by a stranger who accompanies them on the road, who sees how despondent, how flattened, how they just seem like all that might give life and colour has been stripped away from them. And he speaks to them, and they retell all that had been going on, about how Jesus had been arrested and betrayed and crucified and all the rest of it. And then the stranger says to them these words, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. And it's only later on that they realize that this stranger who had joined them on the road was the very same Jesus who had suffered, who had died, who had been buried in a tomb. And Luke goes on to tell us, "Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, 'Where are not our hearts burning within us?' While he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us." And this morning, as we hear the Bible read, our reading comes from our Old Testament, but what those travelers on the road would have recognized as the scriptures, God's word written down. And we're going to hear words from the prophet Isaiah that were spoken long before, not just before Jesus' death, but before his birth, speaking into a particular historical moment. And these words come to us in the form of a song. We're dealing with poetry here, full of images and vibrant use of language. But in the light of all that happened at the first Good Friday and Easter Sunday, in the light of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, we can read the words and hear the words of this ancient song in a new way. In fact, through these words, we can hear the living Christ speaking to us. And so for us too, there should be, like those friends on the road, a moment of recognition as we hear these ancient words and think, well, this is about him. This is about the one whom we say, "I believe." And so George is going to come and read this passage to us, Isaiah, reading from chapter 52 and verse 13 into the next chapter. Thank you, George.
So the reading starts at verse 13 of Isaiah chapter 52. The suffering and glory of the servant. "See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted, just as there were many who were appalled at him. His appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. So he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by man, one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many. He will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great. He will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors.
Thank you. Let me pray once more. God our Father, in thinking about the death of your Son, we find ourselves at the very heart of our faith. And whether this is familiar or unfamiliar territory, we ask that you would help us to meet with you there. Amen. Now, we'll be flitting around various parts of the Bible today, but we'll keep circling back to that passage in Isaiah, so you may well find it helpful to have a Bible open in front of you at those verses in Isaiah 52 and 53. Now, in my kitchen at home, many odd conversations take place. I share my blame, my part in the blame for that, but I was listening to a conversation, a heated discussion about who would win in a fight between various baddies, goodies, and superheroes. And then in a surprising twist, God was brought into the mix, and my ears pricked up, curious as to how this would work out. And it was decided, my opinion wasn't sought, but it was decided that God would win a fight against the baddies and even against the superheroes. God was top of the tree with no competition. A high view of who God is and what God does. These are the opening words from the book of Hebrews. And some of us looked at these in our small groups last week, where it says this: in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful words. And we get the sense that this Son of God, Jesus Christ, who we've been thinking about these last couple of weeks, who is this full and final revelation of God, In him we encounter the full weight of God's glory. Here is someone who is top of the tree. Yet as we return to the next line in the creeds, and we see that having spoken of Jesus' birth, it then says nothing about the 30 years or so of his life, except to tell us that it ended like this, that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended to the dead. And just notice the verbs there, suffered, crucified, buried, descended. And we feel the gravity of those words, that heaviness, that downward drag out of the light and into the shadows. And here it seems that Jesus, God's Son, is not so much at the top of the tree, but has fallen out of it, hitting every branch on the way down. This is a story of humiliation, condemnation, defeat, finality, dead and buried. And so to say, I believe in Jesus Christ, who suffered, was crucified, died, and was buried, has always sounded like foolishness to some. It's proved a stumbling block to others. To put it back on the level of our kitchen table conversation, the things spoken about here, suffering is a goodie. What we want, all these things, they're the baddies, aren't they? What we want is a goodie. What we want is a Superman or a God who's not going to take a backward step in the face of these things. Yet the strange glory of the gospel message, the heart of our faith, is not to say that I believe in Jesus despite knowing that he suffered and was crucified and died and was buried. Those very things, his suffering, his crucifixion, his death, all that we could bracket together as humiliation, are included within and are inseparable from his glory. And so we cannot truly know him or trust him whilst parking that to the side, ignoring it. We certainly can't hear the words of that passage from Isaiah without facing it. And yet we could easily brush over the opening words of that song. Isaiah 52, verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. God, worthy of our and I, is esteemed by God, worthy of our trust, worthy of every honor and praise. And so again, we see the lifting up, the exaltation are not cancelled out or compromised by the trampling down. The honor doesn't rest on what might have been if things had been different, but rest on the very things, the hard things that the servant has done for us and in our place, which is not foolishness, but wisdom. But we need to take this seriously. When we say together, I believe in Jesus Christ, we're saying, I believe in Jesus Christ who was despised. And who doesn't worry, sometimes at least, about what others think about us? Do they think I'm stupid? Do they think I'm embarrassing? Do they think I'm lazy? That feeling we don't like of being compared to someone else, or even making that comparison ourselves. Everything around us trains us to compete with one another, to compare ourselves. You know, school, for many, is a survival exercise. You walk through the gate, and it's a jungle out there or in there, bullying cliques, peer pressure. There's this obvious but unwritten pecking order. Those who are in, those who are out. And we never really grow out of that. We know that there are some rooms in which we matter more than in others. And we find it hard not to make judgments about other people, and harder still to imagine that they wouldn't pass judgment on us. Temptation is always to want to be somehow safe within that, at the top table, with the cool kids. And that pull is so powerful that it can distort even how we see other people or we see ourselves. And Jesus did not conform to who people wanted him to be. He refused to bend to that peer pressure, or for him sometimes political pressure. He didn't play the game. It was as if he alone was standing in the playground, refusing to put on a mask, refusing to take seriously how other people were scoring him against themselves. And so Jesus was viewed with suspicion and scorn, and in the end, openly mocked and despised. Let me read to you just three verses from Luke's account of the crucifixion. This is from chapter 23 and 35 following. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's God's Messiah." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." And so we see there was no one who didn't feel able to look down on Jesus with derision. Not the rulers, not the ordinary passerby, not the condemned criminal. They all felt entitled to look down on Jesus. And so he entered that crossfire of complete contempt. You know, we have the fear that someone else might not like us, or that we might be overlooked. But Jesus experienced all of that, acted out all the cruel judgments that we lay on other people or even ourselves. And in so doing, he exposed the wedge that we put between ourselves and others, between ourselves and God. He faced the contempt as others even hid their faces from him. So once more, Isaiah 53:2-3, "He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem." So this is the one who will be lifted up and highly exalted. This is the one in whom we trust, saying, "I believe in Jesus Christ." We're also saying, "I believe in Jesus Christ who was betrayed." As we read through the accounts of Jesus' final days and hours, we find more than one kind of suffering. Most obviously, there's the physical pain, the nails through his hands as he's raised to the cross. There's the mental anguish of that mocking, being misrepresented. And the very nature of the cross was it's designed to shame. The injustice he experienced as a magistrate, Pontius Pilate, named in the creed, bows to the pressure of a crowd. But there was also that social pain, that pain of separation from those who had been with him, those who had seemed all in, fully signed up, committed, as they fell away and let him down. After sharing the Last Supper with his closest friends, Jesus told them, "This very night, you will all fall away on account of me. For as it is written," once more quoting the scriptures, "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." And so it proves what had been a tight group then completely disintegrates, and Jesus is singled out and left utterly alone. We remember Judas, of course, Judas who handed over Jesus to his enemies for a bag of silver. And each of the four Gospels insists on reminding us that he was Judas, one of the 12. You know, a devastating reminder that the one who betrayed was one who had been trusted, one who had shared so much with Jesus already, not one on the outside tossing stones. It was a sober decision, not a crime of passion. And passionate Peter had his moment of failure too. Peter, who would declare his love, be first to put his hand up, denies Jesus three times because he found himself in a moment where it was inconvenient for him to live up to all his big talk. Earlier still, Jesus fraught with his own anticipation and anxiety about all that was going to happen, asked his friends to stay awake and pray, and instead they fell asleep. And then the nameless crowd who'd welcomed Jesus as a king, singing their songs of praise, waving their palm branches. Surely some of the same crowd would later be among those baying for his blood, shouting, "Crucify him." They allowed Barabbas, this dangerous insurrectionist, a violent man, to be released rather than Jesus, as once again they betrayed perhaps what they thought had mattered most to them. And so Jesus is left completely alone and had that experience of having no one to speak for him as the whole world spoke against him. And Isaiah's servant puts it like this. It's verse 8 of 53. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? Who protested? The passerby? No. The appointed authority? No. His most trusted friends? No. Jesus, who had said, "I'm the good shepherd." Jesus, who said he would never abandon his flock, who would lay down his life for the sheep, is suddenly cast in a different role. He is the lamb, vulnerable and alone, led to the slaughter in silence. Handed over by his betrayer, let down by those who ought to have stood with him. Though, of course, he also hands himself over. And Luke tells us, as he describes the moment when Judas fully, formally hands Jesus over, and the chief priests are there, and they come armed, and Jesus says to them, "Am I leading a rebellion that you've come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns." He hands himself over. This is the one who will be lifted up and highly exalted. This is the one whom we trust as we say, "I believe in Jesus Christ." We're also saying, "I believe in one who was accused and condemned." Jesus' death wasn't an unhappy accident. It wasn't a moment of mob violence. He was arrested. He was accused. Witnesses were brought. He was sentenced. And however improper it was, there was some sort of process, a process that culminates with Pontius Pilate handing Jesus over to be crucified. And as we trace the story through, we find that that was the only ending there could have been. There was this settled determination to silence him. It wasn't enough to sling mud in his direction, to ignore him, mock him, or marginalize him. To take the words of Hebrews again, in the past God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. And they would not listen, and we would not have it. There's a sense in which we cannot live with him. In the very beginning, Adam and Eve onwards, the choice is to ignore or twist or doubt what God has said, to resent any claim over us, to say, "Well, I know best. I'm making my own decision, going my own way." And if what we thought about last week, Jesus' birth, God taking on our flesh, our humanity, is God really saying yes to us, yes to humanity, as we come to the crucifixion and the man upon the cross, we hear humanity's decisive no to God. Shut up and go away. Don't blame us. You take the blame. Don't make us face the consequences. You face the consequence. We get the last word. You don't. And so we have that moment where Jesus is there on the cross, utterly alone, despised. The fragility of that humanity, that human flesh on public display. A sight that many thought pathetic or disgusting, a godless sight. The testimony of Scripture, going right back to Isaiah 53, is that he was there because of us. He was there for us. From verse 4, surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed. So all that sours, in effect, is served up. Our contempt, our betrayals, our muddled loyalties, our sin, in effect, is served up in a single cup, and Jesus drinks it to the very bottom. And we have to say, this is the one who will be lifted up and highly exalted. This is the one we trust, saying, I believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in one who died and was buried. As we read the story of the crucifixion, we join the question, where are the goodies? Where is the hero to save the day? Jesus dies on the cross, his side pierced by a spear, blood and water flowing down. And it's a lifeless body, a corpse that's taken down and then handed over for burial in a borrowed garden tomb. Isaiah 53 from verse 8, he was cut off from the land of the living. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. So Jesus, who had endured contempt and betrayal, condemnation, endures death. And he exposes everything that we fear the most. He faced it all. He faced it for us and in our place. This is the one who will be lifted up and highly exalted. This is the one whom we trust, saying, I believe in Jesus Christ. And of course, the story doesn't end at the cross, but we have to begin there. We have to begin with Jesus entering our darkness, all that bewilders us, and doing so for us, so that with him we might be brought into the light and into life and into truth. And I don't want us to rush on by. So what we're going to do for the next few minutes, for the next 6 minutes, is we're going to sit. And I want us just to think about what we're entering into as we think about what Jesus did for us in that humiliation. But always keeping one eye on where the servant song begins, in that note of being lifted up into exaltation. In the middle of those two extremes stands the cross, and we can't go past it.